start his something that he wants to present exactly at 2 o'clock. So if you are interested somehow, I don't know what it will be about, but he has finished grading your homeworks and would like to tell you something. So
yes.
Yes, and you know, be happy to start telling you that something exactly at 2 o'clock.
Can you give more information than something? Like, are we in trouble?
No. He sent me an email to make his announcement.
I think that we got the email as well.
Yeah,
you
just
spent
half an hour
now
and
said we have
really old
email. I will forward his email. Statistical mechanics.
But we already got the
email. Yeah, that's what you worry about, right?
Okay, good afternoon. So the last lecture, I can't believe we are here. I didn't know what I was getting into when I signed up for this, but I must say I've had a really wonderful time and you all have been asking wonderful questions after class, at lunch, at dinner, you know, and it has been enjoyable. So keep it up. And the last thing I want to do is just continue with what we left off in the previous lecture right at the end. I was talking about the Josephson effect. This effect probes the difference of the phase of the order parameter. And we had some discussion about the exact geometry in which this would be seen. There are many, you know, John Berlinski and I were talking about it, all kinds of shunted net circuits and all that. But I want to keep it simple. So what I want you to keep in mind is the kind of a tunneling geometry. So a tunneling geometry of the kind we can do today with a scanning tip. So this is a tip which you can bring on top of the superconductors S. And let's make the tip also superconducting. Okay, so the tip may or may not be superconducting. If it's a normal tip, so suppose the tip was a normal one, and what you're trying to do is tunnel. If it's normal, then you're tunneling electrons. And in this situation, what you see is a current only when the bias crosses EV is delta, the superconducting delta. And then the current rises. And this is a quasi-particle current. In other words, you're trying to push electrons into the superconductor, and they can go only if the voltage is above the gap. But now, if I do the same experiment with a superconducting tip, here is a superconducting tip. This superconductor has pairs, and at zero bias, even without applying any bias, you can tunnel Cooper pairs. So this is I, this is IC. So here is pair tunneling. And that's what we talked about, that Josephson tunneling. So pairs can still tunnel into the superconducting sample from the superconducting tip, and the current will be proportional to the sine of the phase difference between the two superconductors. Even so, here I want to clarify something. Even if the two superconductors are identical, there can be a phase difference, just because the two superconductors could have chosen different ground states out of the infinite possible states in that Mexican hat. Yes?
Is there a way to rotate the phase of a superconductor?
Yeah, with a magnetic field. So the magnetic field does precisely that. It rotates the field, the phase of the superconductor. And we'll see that. That's the next thing. And then, in addition, when you now, because there are two superconductors involved, this gap here becomes 2 delta, or delta 1 plus delta 2, which are the individual gaps in the two superconductors. But if they are the same, then delta is the same, and then you get this quasi-particle current as well. Okay, so now let's put a magnetic field on this Josephson junction. So I want to go through this quickly because I want to keep a lot of time for discussions. But a good discussion of all this of this topic is Tinkham's book on superconductivity. So you can look that up there. But so what I'm going to discuss next is effect of a magnetic field on the DC Josephson . So once again, let's make the junction I'm going to pick that to be the y direction. That's the junction of thickness D. And that's a superconductor. That's a superconductor. Let's take the junction to be normal or insulator. Okay, so now what is it that I want to show? What I want to show is that that I is equal to some constant I zero sine delta theta that you have without a magnetic field times this function, sine pi phi is the total flux through the junction. So total flux through the system, and phi is the total flux, and that would be the applied magnetic field times. Let's see, let's draw some things here. So I have a magnetic field which is, let's say, coming out of the board. So x, y, and z is coming out of the board. So my h is parallel to z. Okay? And h is parallel to z, and let's say that because of the superconductor, these edges, the magnetic field, I want to make some, I didn't plan it too well. Okay, so I want to make a sequence of pictures which shows how various things will change because of the junction. So here's the junction. Okay, now clearly if I want to know what is the magnetic field, this is the behavior. Here is the field parallel to the z direction. This is superconducting. Now, if I want to plot the field profile, it's going to be the external value within the junction, and it will decay on either side in the superconductor. Right? We don't even have to calculate all this. We can see that right away. But it's contained in the Ginzburg-Landau equations. So we expect the field to look like this. Constant here, decaying into the superconductor on some scale, lambda. This is BZ of X. Okay. So I'm going to pick a gauge again. Del dot A is equal to 0, which implies I'm going to take AY. A is AY of X in the Y direction. And BZ of X, so curl of A is equal to B, and that implies that BZ of X is B del A Y by del X, pointing in the, and so A looks like this. If I plot the vector potential in the y direction as a function of x, then it looks like this. It becomes a constant there. I wanted to change actually on a okay, never mind. That's the vector potential. And I can also write down what the currents will do. And the current, which are these super currents, JS, will be pointing in the Y direction and will depend on X. So again, there's no current in the normal state. No current in the normal state. There's a current in the superconductor on the scale lambda, and it changes in the, it's zero here, and then it goes. Zero up to here, and then there. Right. Okay, so these are all things, slowly take a look at all this, that because of the magnetic field, you know, it produces a vector potential, and that results in this current. Okay, so what produces what? It doesn't matter, but they all go together. Okay, now what are we after? What we are trying to get at, so the whole point of this is that the current depends on some changes of the phases. That's what we are after. So that's why I was trying to get all these different quantities. So we want to know what is the phase difference as I go around this junction in a particular path, which I will draw in a bit. But the point is, when I didn't have the magnetic field, it just picked up the phase difference in the two sides. Now, because of the vector potential or the magnetic field, it will pick up additional phases given by the flux enclosed. And that will then show up in the current. Okay. Now let's come back here. Okay, and now I'm ready to write down the total flux, because that will be given by H times the area that the flux is penetrating. And the flux is penetrating the distance D plus 2 lambda on either side and the other lateral dimensions. So this will be H times the D plus 2 lambda times Y. Y is this thickness. And similarly, in the Z direction, it has some dimension Z. That's the size of the junction. But that's the, D plus 2 lambda. Okay? So that's the total flux that's penetrating this system. And phi naught is the usual hc over 2e flux quanta. So what we will find is that if I look at the current now in a magnetic field, it will have some oscillations. This kind of a Fraunhofer pattern. And we are going to derive this in a bit. But I want you to know where we are headed. so we can keep our eyes out for the effects that matter. Okay, so that's what we are trying to get at. So previously, we just had a constant current in this system, which had a finite difference of the phases. Now that current is modulated by the magnetic field. So it becomes a very important way to detect even magnetic fields. If you know that this minima happens at phi over phi naught, you can use this as a way of detecting the magnetic field in the surrounding that is penetrating it. Okay, so the way the calculation goes is focusing on getting that delta theta. Okay, so if we look in this geometry, and let me make a path which is deep inside the superconductor. Something like this. So I want to get delta theta, which is the difference in phase between the two superconductors. I'm going to look at some path like this. Okay, so I'll go from A to B to C to D. So deep inside the superconductor, J at J is equal to zero, and that implies that delta theta is equal to 2 pi over phi naught times A. This is like the equation we had yesterday when we were discussing flux quantization. Okay, so that implies that d theta by dy is 2 pi over phi naught ay. Okay, so now I have theta L on the left hand side at some point y is given by 2 pi over phi naught. I'm integrating that 2 pi over phi naught ay at x equal to minus infinity times y plus theta L 0. And same thing for theta R. It's 2 pi over phi naught a y x equal to plus infinity times y plus theta R of 0. Okay, so from here we get theta, delta theta of y is defined to be theta L of y minus theta R of y. And that's equal to delta theta at 0 plus 2 pi over phi naught ay at minus infinity minus ay at infinity times y. So it's this, Ay here minus Ay there times Y. Okay, and this is nothing but the integral along, not a closed contour, but just the contour from A to B of A dot dl. So what we get, let's leave that. Okay, so now we have that we know the total flux is given by that that amount h times d plus 2 lambda times y, but the flux along each of those legs I can get in the following way. So if I look at a dot dl on a path, on this path C, which I define to be the contour with, what did I call it, A to B, that AB contour, that line, then this is going to be just the fraction of the flux enclosed in that contour. And so that will be phi total times Y over Y, the full dimension. That's the total size of the junction. Y is the point we are looking at. And so with that, then, what I get is that delta theta of y is delta theta 0 plus 2 pi phi. Sometimes I forget to write total, but 2 pi phi total over phi naught times y over y. Okay, and so if I want the current now, it is integral dy dz of the current density, j, which depends on y and z. Actually, it only depends on y. So that is equal to, I do the z integral. This is from, and then I have to do the y integral from minus y over 2 to y over 2 dy, some j0 sine delta theta 0 plus 2 pi phi total over phi naught y over y. And this I can do, I can call the prefactors j0, et cetera, to be some constant, and I get sine, so I can open that up, sine a plus b, and then do the integral, you know, sine a cos b, and so on, do that integral, I will get a sine delta theta 0, which is constant, times what I had written up there, which is sine pi phi total over phi naught over pi. Push this up a bit. Yeah. Okay, so it's fairly elementary to get this, but the effect is quite profound. So what has happened is that you have a magnetic field which is only penetrating some portion of the junction, which is normal, as well as the portions where the currents are flowing. But the vector potential, of course, exists even outside that region, right? As you know, the vector potential can exist even in a region where there is no magnetic field. So it has to have this form, and it exists outside that region, and that leads to a theta difference between the two superconductors, which depends on the magnetic field. And when you integrate all of that phase difference, what you get is this oscillatory function, which is the Fraunhofer pattern. Yeah, question?
Was that the absolute value of the current?
Okay, so what is that? It is, I'm sort of dividing it out by all this and looking at the maximum current. So I'm just plotting this part of it. So there is some offset. So, you know, the point is...
Yeah, but shouldn't it be negative then for, like...
Yes. I'm looking at the absolute value. So I should have put that. Yeah, you're right. I am looking at, so put down there, mod of the current. So this, I'm just taking out some amplitude as well. I'm just looking at the absolute value of that. So let me write down I max is then some I naught times absolute value of sine pi phi total over phi naught divided by pi phi total over phi naught. And that's what is plotted there. Okay. Now, where does the squid come in? So this itself is a fairly sensitive piece of physics here, because you can see that these oscillations give you maxima and minima on the scale of phi naught. And phi naught is a very tiny magnetic field. So if you look at the value of phi naught, let's see, do I have it somewhere? So phi naught is, phi naught is something like 2 times 10 to the minus 7 Gauss centimeter squared. Okay. It's a very tiny flux quantum, and with this you can measure fractions of a flux quantum. So it depends on how big your ring might be or your device might be, but you know, with the, you can measure fractions of a flux quantum, and that's what makes this already quite sensitive. But now the idea of a squid is to go beyond the diffraction effect and make it into an interference effect, which is even more sensitive. So let me just tell you what is the geometry. It's not that, I don't know what, that mollusk or whatever that you might pull from the sea and eat. But it's amazing. You can make a wonderful acronym like this, superconducting quantum. And it's not even a forced acronym. It's so natural. Superconducting quantum interference device. Okay, and the idea is that you make a ring. And in this ring, you put two junctions. So these parts are superconducting. Here is the insulator, and that is again superconducting. Similarly, here's another junction. So if I were to open it up, what I'm talking about is something like that. Okay, that's what that picture there means. I have these two junctions and denoted by these crosses. Okay, so what you can show for this is that the current is going to be I0 sine delta theta A, where this is A and that's B, and there's some current coming in, plus sine delta theta B. Okay. I've assumed that, you know, the two sides are identical, so I've made the same I naught on the two sides. Okay? Just because I want to focus on the phase. And that is equal to 2 I naught sine delta theta A times cosine okay. So now, once again, I take this contour, which is away from the edges, and let's say there is a magnetic field through this, through the hole. But I'm looking at a contour deep inside, so this is usually denoted by H in my discussion. So in that contour, which is deep inside, on this contour, J is equal to 0, like we have said before. And so I will get integral on C dl dotted with del theta minus 2 pi over phi naught A. This will be equal to 0. Okay? So from here, then we get that delta theta A minus delta theta B is equal to 2 pi phi external over phi naught. And phi external is the flux through the squid, H times the area. And that implies that, so my current, once I have the phase difference, that tells me that the current then I is equal to 2I0. I don't really care about the plus term. That is some sine delta theta A plus delta theta B over 2. Which is not important, but the difference is cosine pi phi external over phi naught. Okay, so that gives me this pattern. Cosine phi over phi naught is, so when the, so I'm going to plot here phi external over phi naught, and this is 0. think I have a mistake here. Okay. This. So 0, half, 1, and so on.
Are you plotting the absolute
value? Yeah. So I'm plotting again the absolute value. So this y plot here. Is the absolute value. So I mod I. Okay? So you get this pattern. So once again, this pattern is unlike that one where it was decaying, here you can get much greater sensitivity. So this is the squid. It has extremely high sensitivity. Okay, so you can see how from an idea of a very powerful idea, not just a little idea, it was a powerful idea, how from the fact that differences in phases can produce currents, how you can modulate these currents in a magnetic field, and the fact that the flux is going to be quantized in units of phi naught. That is coming from the very powerful principle that your wave function going around for this Cooper pair, it has to be single valued. Putting it all together gives us a device then which can be which can measure magnetic fields to fractions of a flux quantum. Okay, so there it is. Superconductivity in action. So now I'm done. That concludes all of these lectures. What we can do now is breathe a little bit and then start discussing more globally. The whole set of lectures. You can ask me any kinds of questions, and we can take it from there. Yeah.
What is the difference between this superconducting current and superflow of the?
No difference. I just use them interchangeably. So usually, when people say superconducting current, they would mean a charged current. Okay, and then we talk about electrons pairing up, making a Cooper pair of charge 2e, having superflow. And producing a current which is 2e times the velocity. Okay, but when I say superflow, then I just mean the velocity part.
But you could have a superfluid with charged bosons, and then
yeah,
there would also be like
a, same thing. Okay. So it would be the Q. Then you would put in a vector potential to describe that problem. Yeah. So the basic aspects of superconductivity don't require a charge, because as I said, you can produce the same effects by rotating it. But since, you know, for us, magnetic fields are much easier to not only manipulate in the lab, but also manipulate theoretically, you know, rather than Coriolis forces going into non-inertial frames. I mean, do you like that? It's kind of. So, but at the level of the formalism, the two are identical. Let me,
I'm hiding part of the board here. Yes. Yeah. I'm just kind of a model, but it goes from, it has a wide gap from one minus one half to one half, then a small gap from one half to one, and. Yeah, should it be three halves or is it one?
Oh, yeah. No, you're right. Thank you so much. I'm glad you're awake. You are awake. No, so this is half. This is one. And then this is three heads.
So in this graph here, like, if you make a measurement of the current, how do you know, like, which branch you're on? Like, how would you know what pi external you have?
You mean, how would you know whether it's here or here?
Yeah.
Right. So you see, you would know, okay, phi would be b times a, and you would only be able to tell modulo to this periodicity, what is the amount of the, because the while the magnetic field doesn't have that 2 pi periodicity, the flux does. So you'll only be able to tell modulo that much. But usually, you can tell. I think that's the answer. Yeah, more questions? Yeah.
I have a question about the Mach insulator.
Okay, so now we are moving off this. Okay, so let's conclude then. Any other questions on just the Josephson effect? Otherwise, we kind of move on now. Okay, so let's. So I should say that, you know, this is a big field today. These Josephson effects are being used today in making qubits. So, you know, you should probably read more about it as you go along, looking at Physics Today, Physics World. You'll see lots of articles on how there are different realizations for qubits. And superconducting Cooper boxes are one of those realizations. So you will see them in that context. OK. So now let's take different types of questions. So let's say, now you can fire away from any part of the course. So we just had a question there.
Yeah, I'm confused about the Mach insulator because what I thought about is, we defined the Mach insulator based on bosons, right? But insulator somehow suggests to me that it's only defined for fermions. Like, how do you define the Mach insulator for a boson?
How do you?
Yeah.
For a boson?
Could you just
clarify
like
okay.
What it is?
So a Mott insulator. So what it refers to is an insulator that is driven by interactions, regardless of whether it's fermions or bosons as the elementary entities. Mott. So Neville Mott is the scientist who emphasized the role of interactions. So essentially, Mott insulator is an insulator driven by interactions. And these are repulsive. So these interactions are repulsive. Okay, so in the case of bosons that we talked about, what you have is, so for bosons, and you can have bosons with spin or without spin. So these are, let's take the simplest one where bosons didn't have a spin. Then, you know, we have that problem of an optical lattice. And in this case, the Mott insulator looked like this. There's a boson in every well. So this can happen as you're changing the chemical potential. So remember what we had some, these were the kinds of pictures you guys made in your tutorial. So as you're changing the chemical potential, let me also draw the density along that cut. sorry, I have to draw the, to twist my, yeah. So if I was trying to draw the density along the same axis, I would have something like this. So here is mu over u, and this is density of bosons, and it would do the following. Here is my lobe, and the density would be increasing as the chemical potential goes up. Then it would go to a certain constant, and then, so this density would be 1. Okay? So what you're doing is you're changing the chemical potential, so the density goes up. But then when it reaches a density of 1 per site, and you're at a U value which is large, you can try to do the same thing here. At that place, you won't get a Mott insulator. So if I try to do it here, you will just find that, you know, your density is some number, and it just uniformly just changes across that transition. There's no transition, in other words. So if I'm at large tunneling, the density just changes continuously. It's always a superfluid. If I'm at small tunneling, then the density increases, but then when it hits 1 per site, it gets frozen into this kind of configuration. And then when I add more particles beyond that, again, it goes out of the Mott insulator. So that's the bosonic story. Does that help?
Okay, so like the fact that we call it an insulator is because we the bosons are not allowed to move?
Yeah, so the insulator comes in because you're looking at some, in this case, you look at a compressibility. Okay, so the compressibility is a good measure of whether something is insulating or not, or conductivity. So the compressibility is delta rho by delta mu. And in the conducting phase or the superfluid phase, compressibility is non-zero because, you know, rho changes with mu continuously. But in the Mott insulator, kappa is equal to 0 because you can see I'm changing mu, but rho doesn't change. So compressibility is 0. Yeah, so that's incompressible. And that's why it's called a Mott insulator. The other reason is you can also calculate a more conducting property, like superfluid density. And the superfluid density is 0, so that means it's not going to flow. Okay, so Mott insulator has this property, and rho s, which is equal to mod psi square. This was the quantity you were plotting in your tutorial. That is 0, so that implies no flow. So these are the two definitions of a Mott insulator. And you can extend it now to a fermionic problem. So in fermions, you have two kinds of spins, and up and down. So in addition to having one fermion per site, as I was saying in my talk, these fermions have also some ordering of the spins. So the repulsion does two things. Repulsion leads to one fermion per site, just like in the boson. But it also orders the spins. So that's a fermionic Mott insulator.
Take the boson anti-condensate.
And take what?
You take the temperature down so you form a condensate. And now there's a superflow.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just add a charge to each boson, now you have a superflow that's a supercurrent. But you never formed any super pairs.
Yeah.
So you don't need to form Cooper pairs to get a, you need the Bose statistics of whatever object you are condensing, okay? If you look at the density matrix, you will see in your homework, which you will get sometime tomorrow, I guess, that if you take fermions and you look at the one body density matrix, it never goes to a constant. So you can't condense fermions. So the reason for forming the Cooper pairs was to generate an object that was bosonic, effectively.
So are there any?
But if you have bosons which are charged, then they will condense.
So are there any superconductors like that? I mean, that are not made up of just like charged superfluids?
So are there charged bosonic superfluids, right? That's what you're asking, where the elementary object is. So in these, so one example that comes, I mean, these ultra-cold atoms are neutral. So those are not going to provide this. The cuprate comes close toward that, I would say. Where, what is the Cooper pair in the cuprate? It is that singlet bond that I was talking about, right? So it is made up of two fermions, but those fermions are very tight. It's on the order of a few lattice spacings. So unlike in usual superconductors where the Cooper pairs are huge, they go over thousands of angstroms. Here it's like 1 to 10 angstroms. So it's a very tight Cooper pair, and it is charged 2E. So that would be one example. Okay, so one thing I could start doing just to get more, I don't know, do you guys have some suggestions how we should spend the next hour or so? Do you want me to give you like an overview of condensed matter or something of that kind?
Yeah.
Or, Okay.
Or what?
Yeah?
Or what? What are the other suggestions?
What?
Ah. I mean, you said a review or, and you didn't complete your sentence.
A review or just take questions. So, you know, since all of you are being a bit quiet. No, I didn't have anything more exciting like, I don't know what you have in mind. Okay, so.
Maybe you can explain basics about topological isolators.
That's something that needs a course, but I can tell you where it might fit in. I can give you some. So, you know, this is the, I kind of thought of a couple of ways of doing this. One is maybe I should just summarize superconductivity in terms of what are the other aspects. You know, we've sort of focused on BCS superconductivity. In my talk, you heard a bit about high temperature superconductivity, but then what are the other ramifications of this topic? So I could say a little bit on that. So we have, I started making a list of what were the different kinds of superconductivity that got, you know, that came into the news post BCS. And it turns out to be a lot of action in this field. So we have the usual, what I will call S-wave singlet phonon mechanism. And these are all BCS superconductors. Then the next example I could come up with is helium-3. Which is neutral. It is a P wave triplet ferromagnetic spin waves. And it is also BCS. Okay? So that should give, that should tell you that BCS doesn't mean it has to be phonon mechanism. And it also doesn't mean it has to be a singlet or S-wave. It can be more general. What makes it BCS is that the coherence length is much, much greater than the interparticle spacing. And then mean field theory is good. That's the regime of validity of BCS theory. Then there was a discovery in magnesium diboride, in which it was found to be two band. So multiple bands become important. It's still S wave, singlet, and possibly phonon. People still argue. This is all very recent now. Even after high temperature superconductors, this was discovered. Possibly phonons, I don't know. Let me just say BCS. Then in, we have high TC. These are D wave, singlet, repulsive interactions. So definitely not any of these waves, weak coupling. It is completely out of that. So repulsive, some kind of Hubbard. It is non-BCS. And if you heard my talk, I would say RVB does explain many aspects of it. There are people who will argue, and they will continue to argue, but I think, I believe it is the correct physics. And it's even being recorded, so that's great. Okay, then we have organics. These are interesting materials from many points of view. Organic superconductors also seem to be all of this. So, you know, more mechanisms of this kind. And then there are discoveries in what are called nictides. These are iron-based superconductors. These also appear to be multiband. Multiband Mott insulators, I think. Most probably non-BCS. So I guess what you're starting to see is here, magnetism and superconductivity are starting to play a role. So in other words, interactions are becoming important. Repulsive interactions which generate magnetism. And that's becoming important, and superconductivity. So the mechanisms are going to become very different. Yeah?
Is plasma a superconductor?
What?
Plasma?
You mean the when you heat something up at very high... you know, that's interesting what you're saying. I would have said no some years back, but now there is this quark gluon plasma, which is different. That's not the plasma you're talking about. So the usual plasma where you just blow things out of shape at very, very high temperatures, right, that's not a superconductor. But there is, people are looking at collisions between two atoms, like two gold atoms, at very, very high energies, driving it into a quark gluon plasma. That plasma has extremely low viscosity. And it has some properties which look very much like a kind of a superfluid property. So there are very important connections between that quark gluon plasma and what is called the unitary Fermi gas in these ultra-cold atoms. So we have the nictides. Then we have, and I'm going to have to stop because there's no more space on the board. I have to write two more things, at least as far as my list tells me.
cesium C60, heavy fermions, boron doped diamond. And actually, I'm going to put the last one as topological. Superconductors or insulators, so on. So in other words, all of these seem to have very important role of magnetism, metallic magnetism, and quantum critical points. So in other words, what I want to point out, the list per se isn't so important. What I want to point out is the research today is in situations where strong interactions produce magnetism, and very often this is close to a quantum critical point, and these kinds of scenarios are not at all understood. And then at the end, I have that topological insulator slash superconductors. These are very new areas, and when you have your next course, you will learn about these, I hope, more systematically. But, okay, it gives you some overview.
Yeah? Can we discuss what other subjects are in condensed matter more than superconductivity, or what you touched here?
More than superconductivity? It sounds like, you know, superconductivity is all there is. Well, it certainly is a very exciting part of condensed matter, but it's, yeah, you're right. That's not all of it. Actually, superconductivity is a very small portion of it. In fact, you won't believe this. When I was a graduate student, my professors at Cornell, they basically said that we don't need to study superconductivity. We were not taught that as a regular course because the general feeling was it was all solved. And it was solved so well by BCS that there was nothing left to do. So why teach a course, you know, on which you can't do any new research? And then exactly the year I graduated, HITC broke. And, you know, we were not well equipped to address that. And Tony Leggett said something very important when I went to Urbana as a postdoc. He said, well, it will decidedly be an advantage not to have known the old theory, because now you can take a fresh look at these new superconductors. And that was really very good advice, because as I said in my talk, none of the old paradigms really explain this new one. So, you know, but yes, you're right. Superconductivity is certainly not all of it. I don't know how best to answer this question, because one of the things is condensed matter is broad. It's not condensed in any sense of the word. It's a bit too broad. And part of my difficulty here has been to condense it in a meaningful way. And that's how this theme of broken symmetry was chosen. And I think it's been a nice theme. We have seen it evolve in different cases. Maybe the best way to answer this as to what else there is to think of interfaces of condensed matter with different things, different areas. So, you know, let's be very egocentric, put condensed matter physics in the center, you know, and think of all the connections. So think of any area, and I will tell you if there's a connection or not. And we can make like a Venn diagram which has intersections, you know? So, you know, lots of you here are interested in string theory. Of course, there's a connection. So here is string theory. You know, who would have thought that condensed matter and string theory would have anything to do with each other? But the way it's coming in is as a calculational tool to address very strongly coupled gauge theories. And you map it on to weakly coupled theory in which lives in a higher dimension. And the strongly coupled theory exists on the surface of a gravitational theory. So that is ADS CFT. OK, name another area.
Particle physics.
OK, yeah. Particle physics. What? What did you say?
Philosophy.
Philosophy too. Foundations. But in a we'll be very concrete, because otherwise it will become like you know, like a soup. But particle physics, very direct connections through, I would say, this unitary Fermi gas that I just mentioned. Unitary Fermi gas and the quark gluon plasma. So this is the quark gluon plasma and the unitary Fermi gas. There is a ratio, eta is the viscosity over the entropy density, and this has some universal value. So eta is the viscosity. S is the entropy density. And this is a universal value. So the physics behind this is quite deep. It's a very deep connection. And that is being made through these unitary gases. Then what else? I mean, there are clearly, we don't even have to go there, but there are clearly direct interactions between material science and chemistry. And I don't mean just in the sense of making materials. From our point of view, what are we interested in? We are interested in novel phases, like topological superconductors, spin liquids, high TC superconductors. All these happen in, you know, they say man-made, but you know, woman-made too. So in, you know, human endeavors. And these materials use a lot of knowledge of material science. So that's the part, you know, we are interested in, where they can throw up some new kinds of materials which have novel ground states. So these spin liquids are very interesting magnets with frustration. We talked a bit about it in the class, and that requires this connection. You know, you might also put in, let me put it in here. Biophysics has a connection.
Cosmology.
Pardon?
Cosmology.
What did you say?
Cosmology.
Cosmology, yes. So Patrick Peter is here. If you want to talk to him more about it, we have been discussing things like these vortices, which are cosmic strings, and they have you know, some connections between the two. So cosmology, and there may be even more. So if you want to discuss some of these things, you should talk to him.
Well, I think they model some things in the cosmos with superfluids.
Yeah, so you should talk to him. He will tell you more about it. So here, let me put down cosmic superconducting cosmic strings. And there may be more. You know, my own knowledge is fairly limited in making these connections. So, you know, we have to keep that in mind. And of course, there is the optical lattices I talked about. So atomic and molecular physics. We should also put down computer science through this quantum information now. Of course, you might say, what is condensed matter doing there, right? But there are many issues about, you can make different realizations of these qubits,
and discuss what is the decoherence, where is the decoherence coming from, how much is the entanglement. So condensed matter would come in there as well. And you know, these RVB states that I talked about, these are spin singlets. And that's very much what is used in Bell's inequality. When they are testing this, they are making these spin liquids. So you know, aspects of decoherence of these spin liquid states could again be important there. So yeah.
So what inside condensed matter physics?
So condensed matter physics is all of this and more. So what we have talked about are the intersections. And in a way, what you can think about when you say what else is there, so I would say maybe a good way to ask this question is to say, what are you interested in? And then, you know, you don't need to worry about what it is called. Forget the name, condensed matter. You know, you're interested in a particular question. It doesn't matter. You can find that area represented somewhere. But if you were to push me to define it, and I'm not going to try to define it, but you could do it through the Hamiltonians that we have been writing down. So you know, traditionally, it has been the study of materials. That is what it has been. But as we have seen, it has become a very sophisticated field. So it started out in sort of, you know, taking different materials and just understanding, is something a metal or is something an insulator or what? That's how the field started. And you know, we are still kind of doing the same kinds of questions, but it's becoming more sophisticated, like new kinds of phases, spin liquids, topological insulators, and so on. So broadly, the field could be defined by saying it's emergent states of matter, which did not exist in the elementary Hamiltonian, but was generated because of interaction effects. And these interactions could be of various kinds, like we've talked about. So one way could be to say, OK, I have my Hamiltonian. And this is limited, because as you've seen, I don't have to talk about materials. I can talk about atomic gases. But I could say it has some electronic part. It has some ionic part. Some, let's say, V electron electron, or let me just do it like that. It has some ionic part, and it has electron and ion. And the electronic part itself is of the kind, you know, where you have kinetic energy plus some V interactions. The ionic part has a potential, has kinetic energy of the ions plus VII, and then we have HEI, which is the interaction. So this, you could say, is, you know, this is like our theory of everything. You know, you've seen these our particle physics people, you know, doing this theory of everything. This could be that kind of theory of everything. It has all possibilities in it. You could add, if you want, a magnetic field. And then you can talk about quantum Hall effect. And you can talk about spins and orbitals coupling. So now you have all possible interactions. And you know, you can see it has, what we did in the course are different portions. So nobody in their right mind will try to put everything on a computer and try to solve it. That would be insane. So you have to have the judgment or the intuition to see in any situation what is important. Pick those portions and then try to solve that. And we saw it many times in action, right? We would pick different portions. And so you saw that if I have just this,
just the kinetic energy, that's the Fermi gas. We put in interactions and they are weak, it's a Fermi liquid. We make the interaction stronger, it can take you to a Wigner crystal. Or it can take you, so this line itself can go from Fermi gas to Fermi liquid to a Wigner crystal of electrons. It can also generate magnetism and give you all kinds of magnetic states. This portion here gave us lattices and excitations, phonons, which were quantized. And when you combine, and you know, within this subclass itself, from magnetism, you could get superconductivity. And also here, between Fermi liquid and phonons, could give superconductivity, and so on. So it gives some kind of an overview picture of you know, the different players in the field. Okay. I see some smiling faces. Is there a reason? What's up? What's the joke? Okay. Should we call it a day? Do you have more questions? I would say going into the next step, you guys have a good idea about, you know, how we take different Hamiltonians and what are the different kinds of phases we are getting. I think at the next step, you're ready to take on some of these strongly correlated problems and write it as an effective field theory. And that's what I was alluding to in my talk. You have these interacting Hamiltonians. You can write a partition function, trace e to the minus beta h, and write it into a field theory. And now start evaluating these strongly coupled field theories. And you can start by doing perturbation theory and then get more sophisticated. So that could be exciting to just see how you know, any of these interaction or anything, all of these interacting Bose Fermi problems can be written into path integrals, and you can start to see the interplay between statistical quantum statistical mechanics.
Call it a day there. I got the honor of thanking you for this class.
Oh my God.
We have a teacher for you from
thank you.
Side program.
Thank you very much.
Also,
okay.
Us in the class.
Thank you. That's wonderful. It's never happened before. I should show this to all my other students. They better. This is amazing. Thank you. Thanks to all of you for this. T-shirt. No, this is perfect. So thank you. Okay, time to go and have some beer.